The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. 4 minutes past nine for this Wednesday, the 4th of February. How are you all keeping? I do hope you're very well. I hope your day's going good so far. Thanks so much for joining us here on the show for the next couple of hours. We'll keep you informed and entertained, hopefully. And we've loads to talk about, and we want you involved in that conversation. And just a reminder at the top of the show of how you get in contact with us. Well, 086 60 25000 is the WhatsApp or the text number, whichever you prefer. You can always give us a call as well on 07491 25000. And if email is your preferred line of communication, well, comments at highlandradio is the address for you. And that goes for you if you're listening to the podcast or indeed the overnight replay. We love your comments coming in too. Just send them in to us and we can pick them up and carry them into the next live programme. Don't forget you can watch the show today as you can every single day here. We broadcast the full 2 hours on YouTube, so you can watch it on your smart TV, your Fire Stick or your mobile devices, whatever suits you. Just search Highland Radio, Highland Radio Ireland, and we're on Facebook and on the X platform as well. Let's have a quick look at some of the papers this morning. We'll start with the Finn Valley Post. The Finn Valley Post, that's, I have that, Finn Valley Voice, I beg your pardon. Do you know when I said it? I know I had it wrong. The Finn Valley Voice. St. Columba's College in Stranraer is the only school in counties Donegal, Sligo, Leitrim and Mayo to have been included in the government's $7.55 billion National Schools Investment Programme. Now, they're not national schools, it's just a National Schools Investment Programme. The multi-million euro proposed development announced last Wednesday at the 1,000-student Stranraer schools expected to go to construction this year. Tom Roan, principal of St. Columba, said, "We're absolutely delighted with the good news that our school has been selected in the National Schools Investment Programme. We've worked on this project for 11 years since 2015, when the principal was Maeve Scully, and congratulations. It is wonderful news for the school and the area as well." But that's quite remarkable and stark when you look at it. One school in Donegal, Sligo, Leitrim and Mayo included in a €7.55 billion project. It would make you think. Plenty of coverage this morning on new findings that show courts here take three times longer than EU averages to conclude cases. And this comes up on this programme quite a bit. People believe the justice system moves too slow. I wonder, does it deter people sometimes then engaging in the process where they have a say? But Irish courts are taking considerably longer than the European average to dispose of cases and are facing an increasing backlog each year, according to a new report on the health of the justice system. Notwithstanding the length of time involved in resolving cases, trust in the Irish judiciary and the courts is high, a major report from the Law Society's Centre for Justice and Reform Ireland. The centre's Justice Indicators report evaluated the resourcing, effectiveness and efficiency of the justice system. But the bottom line is that we have far fewer judges compared to the countries we are compared to. That is, of course, is going to be a factor. How long and how often courts can sit. We need more judges. Voluntary contributions has been on the agenda for the last wee while. It always comes up on this programme. When is it voluntary? When is it not? It often feels like it's not voluntary at all, or it's not made clear the contribution is voluntary. But parents will have to be told by schools about the amount of money generated from voluntary financial contributions they are asked to make and how it is being spent under new rules to be introduced by government. Now, I think this is kind of a sticky wicket for schools because, you know, some schools will gather in this funds and they might spend some funds in one place and use the voluntary stuff for other things that maybe some parents might say, well, is it worth putting it into the arts or whatever it might be? Really, it's interesting that the government is calling on schools to be more transparent about financial contributions, but the reason those financial contributions are needed in the first place is because there's not enough funding from government to schools for free education. So schools that want to give the most full educational experience, which isn't always about, you know, sitting in class learning math, you know, they're having to ask parents to support that. It's kind of just interesting that it's the government that really should be funding schools more, yet it's they that are asking the schools to be more transparent with the funds they have to gather because of the shortfall, if you get where I'm coming from. Minister for Education Hildegard Nocton is to put forward plans for a new statutory charter to strengthen accountability in schools. In 2023, charities maintained that some parents were being asked for payments of €350 or more in voluntary contributions. The government has previously insisted that it must be made clear to parents that such payments are not compulsory. However, schools say they're forced to seek money from parents because they do not receive sufficient state funding to meet everyday expenses. So we're interested in what the implications of this might be. Like, I'm all for transparency. I think everything in this space should be transparent, but that means everything, including government's funding of schools and why it doesn't fund them more than perhaps it should. Well, not perhaps. I don't think that's controversial. Right, on to the Irish Daily Mail. Some comments which kind of jarred me. When Jan Leeming booked a table at an upmarket 17th century country hotel as a birthday treat for a friend, she expected the fine food and wine in a tasteful setting. But the XTV news reader claims what she actually got was an expensive lunch spoiled by a screaming child whose parents seemed unwilling or unable to control the youngster. Miffed, she complained on X about her experience at the Pig at Bridge Place in Kent, South East England, and struck a chord with some of her 12,000 followers who've also had meals ruined in restaurants and pubs by children. Miss Leeming, 84, said the parents seemed oblivious and that if diners could afford gourmet food at high-end venues, they could afford a babysitter. She also accused staff at the Pig at Bridge Place of treating her badly when she complained and said some even played with the child instead of asking its parents to deal with tantrums. What do you think about this? It's funny, we had received a similar communication from a listener and posted on our socials just in the context of this. We were going to do it anyway, but now seemed the right time to do it. I don't really think how much you pay should determine whether or not you're disturbed by children. You think at 84 you'd realise that, you know, not all misbehaviour is misbehaviour either. And just because you're rich, why should you be insulated by the realities of everyday life? I love the sound of children. I've never been disturbed eating. And, you know, sometimes too, you recognise that maybe there is a child that on the face of it seems like they're misbehaving. But that could be the parents' wedding anniversary and they've got no family support. And maybe the child is playing up because it's bold, right? That's a very old-fashioned point of view. Now, obviously, we've all seen cases, and maybe I've been guilty of it in the past, whereby you could be a little bit more authoritative with the child, but it's not always the case. I just don't think I just think it's so snooty that someone, especially who's 84 and should know better, thinks that because they're paying more money to go into a place that they should have a different experience to the rest of us in terms of everyday life. Or maybe you are of the view that no matter the circumstances, if your child can't behave or be seen to be behaving, then you shouldn't be in a public space where other people are trying to chill out and relax. That's not right or wrong. I mean, there's a sort of a wokey way of looking at it and not, as some might describe it. But what do you think? Let us know. 08660 25,000. Is she wrong or is she right? If you pay big money to go in for lunch and a dinner, should it be in a certain environment that is sort of quiet and la-di-da? But why should having money, you know, why would you want to insulate yourself from everyday life either? I don't know. What do you think? As I say, it's never bothered me. And I often think, because I've been there, and I was kind of there yesterday too, sometimes kids don't play ball and you don't know in advance and there could be different reasons for it. On to the Sun this morning, and the chair of the Dáil committee probing the use of AI by social media giants yesterday blasted X for refusing to send anyone to answer questions about online safety. Alan Kelly said it was extremely disappointing after Taoiseach Micheál Martin also asked the firm to appear before the watchdog. Reps from Google, Meta and TikTok will appear before the Committee on Arts, Media and Sports today. But there will be no one from Elon Musk's X, which has faced global criticism over its AI chatbot creating deepfake sexualized image of people, including children. The French don't take any prisoners. The French have raided X's office in France, and Elon Musk posted on his platform about it being politicised or a political witch hunt or something along those lines. And a Twitter account, an ex-account, on behalf of the French government said something along the lines of that argument might work on an island somewhere, but not in France, which when a country is calling you out like that, that is that's next level stuff. Interesting, though, I was listening to a bit of RTE on the way in, and they were talking about X, and they referred to child pornography on X, which I thought was really quite regrettable, because it's not child pornography, it's sexual abuse images of children. And I think the national broadcaster should be using that terminology. When it comes to the courts at the moment, the legislation is written whereby these images are referred to as child pornography. But child sexual abuse imagery is, or some version of that's a better way to phrase it, and it wasn't based on an Irish court case. So editorially, I'd love to see if RT would change that language, because it's not child pornography. These are children that are being abused. On to the Irish Daily Mirror now, and plans to ban scramblers in any public place will go before Cabinet today. Transport Minister Dara O'Brien will bring proposals to senior ministers, and if approved, it will enable the immediate drafting of regulations to prohibit scramblers on all public places, including roads. This will not require new legislation, but will be built on existing legislative frameworks. Minister O'Brien also intends to amend existing regulations to streamline the process for confiscating and destroying seized scramblers, and that's off the back of that awful tragedy last week. Dara O'Brien, of course, now the Minister for Transport. We are still engaging with his office to try and get some sort of a comment on the decision to take away the afternoon flight from from Dublin to Donegal. We were talking about that extensively on the programme yesterday. And also to have the PSO flight grounded in Dublin overnight and then flying up to Donegal in the morning, the concerns being that it could be delayed or cancelled because of the busyness of Dublin Airport. Of course, his office is responsible for that, and we are continuing to make inquiries in relation to that. And finally, the Bermuda Triangle has long been shrouded in mystery, with countless ships and boats vanishing without trace in its waters. But scientists reckon they may have solved the puzzle after uncovering forces beneath the ocean. Experts have long suspected a mixture of environmental factors and methane gas bubbling up from the seabed has wreaked havoc on the buoyancy of craft. It's a world away from far-fetched theories of alien abductions or time portals. Scientist Ronald Napper told What If Science that a methane field could have existed in the area but may have since dissipated. Lee was talking a little earlier on about things from your childhood, or maybe words, not from your childhood, but from years ago that no longer exist. I remember, and I think I've said this on the programme before, the Bermuda Triangle was like real. It was always talked about as if it were real when I was younger, and I believed it must exist because there were documentaries. And then all of a sudden, no one talked about the Bermuda Triangle anymore. It just went out of favour. I suppose it's like the Loch Ness Monster too. There used to be an awful lot of talk of that when I was younger, but that all went by the wayside as well. Maybe we're too busy thinking of other things. We're joined on the programme now by Councillor Declan Meehan, member of the Regional Health Forum. Good morning, Declan. Thank you for your time.
Morning, Greg.
Right. We read a report recently which shows that the HSC still owns almost 200 vacant properties in sites across the country. 10 of those are in County Donegal. So do we know the makeup of the properties in Donegal?
So I suppose when we talk about 10 properties in Donegal, there's a variety of them which are being considered for disposal and ones which are actually in the process of being disposed of, if you like, which basically means that they're in the process of being sold. But they're kind of right across the county. The old Dunfanaghy Health Centre, the old Fulcara Health Centre, right over to Lisfannan as well. So they're all over the county, and they vary massively in size, both in the size of the building and the size of the sites.
Would any of them be useful, do you think? Because I can imagine, and maybe some of those that you described are, we're familiar with these sort of tiny little houses on the outskirts of villages, right, which is effectively one room with a really small office off the back of it, which is probably of no use, really, unless someone were to extend it or develop it. Some of it's going to be that type of property, I presume.
Yeah, there's a number of them which are those old standard buildings, which are probably built around the 50s or 60s to a standard design. But I think that even when you consider those, you know, they can be located in the centre of towns and villages, and they could be ideal locations for other things or for development on that site. So I think that questions need to be asked around the disposal process that the HSE goes through, what assessments and reviews of the property are taken into consideration. Like a note, even say last year on the HSE capital plan, there's a number of planned decongregation sites or residences, which is basically independent living units. And some of these could be potentially useful for housing independent living units in them for, you know, a person or a couple or whatever, even if it's small, or if they're extended on site. Again, they're ideally located in the centre of towns and villages. But I think as well, you know, an awful lot of these sites nationally haven't even been considered by the Land Development Agency for potential housing. And I think that as a matter of course, all state-owned land should be considered first and foremost for other state uses by agencies, including for housing.
So in layman's terms, are you saying the likes of Donegal County Council should get first dibs on these properties, assess them and see if they could be repurposed?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I don't see why not. I think that when we look at, if we knew more about the HSE's process and how they assess this, if they don't consider themselves to have any use for that site, rather than putting it on the private market, that first dibs should be given to other state agencies like Donegal County Council for the development of single unit housing or maybe small housing developments. Because again, an awful lot of these are ideally located in town and village centres.
In terms of how we are planning for the future, are we looking at the type of properties, the type of developments we might need, Declan? You talked about maybe congregated living or whatever it might be. You know, we know where we're going demographically. From inside looking on, are we planning for what we know? Because sometimes we try and make decisions without the data, but we have the data of what kind of housing stock we'll need.
Yeah, look, I mean, the short answer for that, Greg, is that we're not planning. We're not planning sufficiently for an older demographic. We don't have the housing stock that we know that people want to be able to right-size or to downsize as they become older. And also in terms of social housing, there's such a flurry, obviously, and there needs to be to meet current demand that's existing in the system that we don't have the time or the foresight to actually look forward and say, do you know what we're actually going to need is an awful lot of 1 and 2 bedroom houses that are single story, that are in town and village centres for older people to be able to right size later on in life.
Yeah, and as a choice, you know, that's
as a choice.
Yeah, because a lot of people will want to do that. Finally, any update in relation to any information from the Department of Housing on a scheme for social housing affected by defective concrete blocks, Declan?
No, oh, look at Greg, at our last effective concrete blocks meeting there a few weeks ago in Lifford, it was the same old story. And, you know, to be very fair, Greg, you have to feel for the staff that are responsible for the so-called social housing remediation scheme, because it's non-existent at the minute. The council are doing a lot of preparatory work to have houses ready for remediation, but we are still getting nothing from the Department of Housing. And in that last meeting, we as a committee looked for a delegation to go to Dublin to meet with the Department of Housing to press this as a standalone issue. You know, I'm being contacted, I'm sure my colleagues are too, on a very regular basis, a number of people every single week, living in really, really terrible conditions and paying for the privilege to do so in the form of rent to Donegal County Council. And the Department of Housing need to get their finger out and start delivering for these people, because it's It couldn't be more urgent. We're years into the private scheme at this stage. We have been told for as long as I've been on Donegal County Council now, which is over a year and a half, that the social housing remediation scheme is imminent. And imminent obviously loses all meaning when you're still waiting.
But at least tell us what is the delay? What's the holdup? Because the housing minister, shortly after his appointment, said to us imminently it's a priority. He said to somebody else there towards the end of last year, a couple of weeks away even, right? So if give us a timeline, what's the holdup? What could possibly be the delay? Because it's a purgatory for people living in these houses. And as you say, you know, we've all had contacts from parents concerned that their children are in rooms with the black mould in the corners, all the stuff that we're told is not just damaging to your health in the short term, but the long term as well. So, I mean, this is a... And yet we see the other scheme down the country progressing without hardly any political pressure, which I don't get.
I think that this is the real frustration, is the lack of communication over this, the lack of urgency from Dublin on delivering on this. And I suppose, the unfortunate thing is that none of us can be surprised about this because, you know, it's the usual story when it comes to Donegal and lack of urgency, the government's attitude to this part of the country and our government TDs ineffectiveness of being able to push this scheme forward. We are talking about up to 1,800 houses at the best estimate at the minute. That's going to take an awful long time to remediate. Mm. Like, we're currently seeing up to 400, 500 housing units by Donegal County Council either in progress or on site. And yet we know that we have, on top of the thousands of people on the housing waiting list ordinarily, an extra 1,800 households that need to be re-accommodated, either in their existing homes being remediated or, you know, very likely being relocated elsewhere in a different development. So, you know, we need to know exactly what's going on because we need to be able to progress this for the people.
The papers,
who are suffering
every paper, front pages, inside for whoever buys them, it's all about, you know, Facebook and all of these social media companies coming before a committee to talk of transparency, openness, explaining algorithms, you know, what's going to happen next, talking about CEOs being held accountable. Great, I agree with all of that. But the very same people that are seeking transparency and openness and accountability from others, they won't even tell us what's the holdup with this scheme, who's making the decision, what's the delay, who's ultimately responsible. We're always seeking an ultimate person, a person ultimately responsible in other areas, and yet, complete without irony seemingly, we don't enjoy as citizens the same in this country from our government on critical matters like
not.
Why is this portion of this scheme delayed?
Yeah, 100%. And look, it's but one example of
it's the most current,
from this government. And look, we'll keep pushing this in terms of members of the Defective Concrete Blocks Committee and other councillors on Donegal County Council. But the reality is the Minister for Housing, as I've said a number of times since getting elected, whoever that minister is, it seems to not matter. But they need to get their finger out and deliver this scheme so that people can start to get on with their lives, because this is still going to take
over a decade.
You see,
I believe he came in with a new brush. I think he proved himself early on to be looking at this in a different way, to wanting to brief himself on it, not necessarily just to get a folder handed him by Dara O'Brien. That's the impression I got from him. But it seems that when we get down to particular elements of this, the nitty-gritties, it's radio silence. And I don't mean that literally. You know, all of a sudden, what seemed to be, you know, green shoots of positivity, it just becomes what we've come to expect.
Yeah, and look, I think that this speaks an awful lot sometimes to the inefficiencies of government and the power of the civil service in each department. But where there is a will, there is a way. And what we see here, and in particular in relation to Defective Concrete Blocks, whether it's the private scheme and amendments being made to it, or whether it's the social housing remediation scheme, there is no will there to do that. And that's ultimately where we're left.
Let's see. Okay, thank you very much indeed. That is Councillor Declan Meehan there, 086 60 25,000. That's the WhatsApp and the text number. I know for many families, school voluntary contributions can be frustrating. But the government says parents will have to be told by schools about the amount of money generated from voluntary financial contributions they're asked to make and how it's being spent. But there is the irony here in that schools, of course, will argue that they're having to raise money from parents because of a shortfall in government funding for schools. So we'll try and square that circle with Paul Crone, Director of the National Association of Principals and Deputy Principals. Good morning to you, Paul. Thank you for your time.
Good morning, Greg. Delighted to be here.
So in the first instance, it's up to each school. It's at their discretion, is it? You know, how much to seek from parents. Talk to me about what the likely process of that is at the start of the year or when budgets are being worked out.
Well, a voluntary contribution is not something that is new. Schools have been charging it for a long time. But in the last, I suppose, 5 to 6 years, it's been clarified by numerous ministers that it is a voluntary contribution, and there has been a conscious effort by government to reduce the cost of schooling with the School Books Initiative to reduce the cost on parents. However, schools have been chronically underfunded over the past number of years, and we're quite unique in many ways in an Irish context in that the school is the centre of the Irish community, which is not the case in some of our European counterparts. So schools offer a curricular programme, a co-curricular programme, an extracurricular programme, and in fairness, the teachers give up their time voluntarily to do that. Yet there is a real need to fund those activities, be it school buses, be it equipment for sports, equipment for music, drama, chess, all of those other activities, co-curricular activities such as visits to plays or things like that. So a school will look at, on the basis of over the last number of years, what it has been able to offer and what the costs of those activities are and how they may have changed, and we'll try and put a figure on it, being very mindful that they don't want to overburden parents, but they do want to try and use the loaves and the fishes analogy to try and get the best value out of limited resources that they can get.
Do you think it would be fair to say, Paul, that the government does provide enough funding for the core elements of education, i.e., you know, you get into school, the teachers pay, you know, the lighting, the heating, and then away you go again. Is there enough funding from the state for that? And when we talk about voluntary contributions, are we talking about additional things that make sort of maybe the educational experience more rounded?
In general, schools would not use the voluntary contribution to pay for core activities. Schools have been under pressure as of late with the cost of living increases, and particularly with fuel prices. And that's been acknowledged by successive governments over the last number of years that have given once-off cost of living increases to schools. And for the first time in many, many years, this year they did increase the capitation to schools. But yes, the Department of Education cover the cost of the teacher's salaries. They cover some routine maintenance. They cover emergency works on buildings, all of that. And they give school money to provide classroom materials. They give them substantial money for school books and all sorts of things like that. Yet there is absolutely no funding for the extracurricular program, which we all know in Ireland, many students will choose the school that they want to go to because of the extracurricular offerings that they would make. A student who is musical will go to the school that puts on the best musical. It's same with hurling and football. They would go to particular schools for that. And it's an integral part of Irish society. So, yes, we would be calling that schools do require more funding to offer the full holistic package to students. All this talk of well-being is so important, and we recognise that we want to produce well-rounded individuals, and well-being comes from connection and being connected with the school, feeling that you're valued and that you have a connection. The extracurricular and co-curricular programmes play such an important role in that for schools.
the Minister for Education is getting involved to try and get more transparency in this area. Now, initially for me, that kind of slings a bit of mud, right? Because why would an education minister be seeking more transparency unless she thought there was something going on? I'm not saying that's what her motivation is, and I'm certainly not saying there's something going on, but that's the kind of environment it creates for me, to be honest with you. Would there be any resistance to more transparency, i.e. we raised €27,000 through voluntary contributions, €7,000 went on gym equipments, €8,000 for the school play, you know, €4,000 for school instruments and such and such. You know, will there be any pushback or resistance in relation to that, do you think?
The short answer to that is no. This is part of what is the Charter Bill, which has been on the cards for quite a while, which is going to put into a legislative footing for the first time the partnership agreement between or arrangements between schools, parents and students. And over the last number of years since the Ministers for Education have come out and said the voluntary contribution is exactly that, voluntary, and parents don't have to pay it, schools have voluntarily started to do that process anyway and say, look, if you're giving us this amount of money, this is what we're spending it on. This is the value we can add. So they have been doing that anyway for parents. And what they, by doing that, what they have noticed is that there has been a slight increase in the payment of the voluntary contribution because parents can see the value. They want to invest in their child's future and in their positive school experience. So I don't think there'll be any resistance, and I think that transparency is a positive thing, and it protects everybody.
If it's, I mean, obviously each individual school is individual, and you do get stories of certain schools doing things a certain way where it's not, your payment is due and you keep getting the texts, right? And it's not really framed as voluntary. I have them on my phone, so I can say that without fear of contradiction, that you get a sense that, you know, you have to pay this. Should it not be made more clear that, you know, if you can afford to pay this, we would very much welcome it. Stop bombarding some schools, bombarding parents with texts where it feels like it's your credit card company having a go at you. And also to ensure that no school seems to connect an experience or a service at a school with the payment of these voluntary fees. Do you know, I'm saying some bad apples could be the whole barrel's worst enemy in this. Would you recognise that that is the case and that maybe we need to be slightly more uniformed and genuinely more transparent about what is and isn't voluntary?
No, I mean, you make a valid point, and it's the same in everywhere. Schools are put to the pin of their collar, and they really value the parent contribution. And if schools are overzealous in the collection, that's not right. And it has to be the partnership arrangement that the school sees value in the parents' partnership, and the parents sees value in what they're doing. And that's the way it should be. And I think the purpose of the Charter Bill is to put that on a statutory footing and to put in procedures that will operate universally and nationally, so that nobody feels under that level of pressure. And I can understand if a parent cannot afford to pay a voluntary contribution, but they need to go up to the school and they're being pressured, but they need to go up to the school to talk about their child. We can't have them feeling reluctant that they want to go up, that they don't want to go up to the school, because that partnership needs to be cemented and it needs to be fully operational. So from that perspective, I do accept that point, and those practices need to be regularised.
All right, listen, thanks, Paul. Look after yourself. That's Paul Crone, Director of the National Association of Principals and Deputy Principals. Traffic, presumably in and around Letterkenny, is certainly getting your text in this morning. Traffic in Letterkenny is mental at the minute. I left Manor at 20 past 8 to be at a 9:20 doctor's appointment. I'm only at Ben Sweeney's now, and I've probably missed my appointment as it's now 9:32. Oh my word. What is going on with the traffic in Letterkenny this morning? I'm 20 minutes on the dual carriageway. I timed it from the turn-off at Trimra, and now 20 minutes later, I'm only at Kelly's Garage. I'm a business owner who pays a lot in rates and just find this traffic very frustrating. Is there any real movement on getting this new bridge, or is it just all talk? Well, a little bit from column A and a little bit from column B. Fuming this morning, I live in a estate in Donegal where the contractor is finishing housing and putting in Ukrainians. I'm driving my kids to school and the bus is picking up theirs to take them to school. What a joke Ireland has become, and looking for a house and can't get one, so the Irish go homeless, both of us working and them getting everything handed to them. That's, we need to dig a little bit into that. We might call you back and try and get some information as to where you're talking about. We have an open rental market here, I'm not sure. Are you saying that these houses have been targeted at certain individuals? Are they paying rent? Is it private houses? Is it public houses? You know what I mean? Like, I understand where you're coming from. I understand the frustrations, but we need more information in relation to that. And although the council are taking rent from the tenants, so why are they not obliged to fix these houses themselves and stop blaming Dublin? It's an interesting point. It really is an interesting point. Re-children in restaurants and re-children in public. Rich people don't put manners on their spoiled brats. Another, hi Greg, we went to Gordon Ramsay's in Liverpool with four kids. Afterwards, an older couple approached us to commend us on the behaviour of our children. We were delighted. I suppose manners is easily carried, but not every child takes instruction in the same way. And sometimes there can be other reasons as to why their behaviour appears bold. There could be, for an example, and every child is different. That's why I'm avoiding terminology, but they could be on the autism spectrum, for an example. Are those parents not entitled to go out and have something to eat as well? A caller says that lady clearly has no children. Yeah, indeed. I think if you have children, you understand it's not always like that. And you can say in the kitchen, right, we're heading now. Are you going to be a good boy? You're going to be a good girl? Yes, yes, of course. And halfway through the starter, then it starts. What do you do? Do you get up and leave? Or do you sit and endure it? You know exactly what I'm talking about. And then people are looking at you. It's the same if you go shopping, you know. There's mums and dads go shopping. They don't have any support with them. They have to bring their child who might play up in the shop, in inverted commas. They could be for other reasons. And everyone's looking at them and it makes life really, really tough. Sometimes we just need to take a deep breath and think about the situation. You're sitting there, lovely steak, you've got the money to buy it. What's other people going through? What's their story? What's their lives? What's in their minds? Let's go to Adrian Gallagher, National Chair of the Irish Farmers Association Sheep Committee. Thanks for joining us, Adrian.
You're welcome, Greg.
Right, you and others from Donegal are part of a group from the Donegal IFA officers at an IFA's protest at Boardbia HQ. For those who may not be aware, what is this protest about?
Well, for the listeners that are unaware of it, Greg, I suppose this protest originated when information came out from Larry Moran, who not only sits on the board of Boardbia, but he also chairs the board. And his company is importing Brazilian beef and using it in his processed food factory that he has here in Ireland, and exporting that then across Europe and in the UK. And of course, as you all know, Boardbia is our Irish brand for promoting Irish food and drink right across Europe and in the world, of course. And it just doesn't sit with farmers and the members of IFA, farm families who have to go out and become Boardbia approved and to do an awful lot of, let's say, jump through a lot of hoops, do a lot of recording, do a lot of medicine recording, doing you're tracking everything you do in the farm to ensure that your animals leaving the farm are Boardbia quality assured. But yet you have a man who sits on the board and chairs that board of Boardbia important Brazilian beef.
The government said last week they don't want to rush to judgment in this, and opposition parties have called for his resignation. How long are you prepared to stay in situ in relation to this?
Well, Greg, we've been protesting here now since last Monday week, and our protests remained outside the doors of the headquarters here in Pembroke and Dublin. And yesterday, the decision was made to move inside the doors. So we had a mandate for around 50 to 55 IFA members all enter the building and remain, took up position in the reception area. Some, unfortunately, had to leave for a reason then last night. But there was 15 IFA members remained in the lobby. and stayed the night in the lobby, and we are currently locked in the lobby, and we intend to stay until Larry removes his position, be it voluntary or by the Minister of Agriculture.
Yeah. Okay, Bord Bia say that, you know, they respect anyone's right to a protest, but this is affecting staff, intimidating staff, you know, now that the protest has moved indoors. What do you say to accusations like that?
Well, those accusations are completely untrue because we're sitting in the lobby area. As you know, as any business or anything, nothing happens in the lobby area. All business happens upstairs in the offices. We haven't intimidated any staff. We've worked with the receptionist to use the facilities, and they've been working with us as well. So, no, I would have to say that there's been no intimidation by any member of AIDS.
Is it fair to judge Mr. Moran on the activities of his company compared to his role as the head of Bord Bia? The government said that he has overseen record exports of Irish agri-food products in recent years. So in terms of his role at Bord Bia, the government say he's doing a superb job, record-breaking job.
Well, I wouldn't agree with that. Not for 1 minute, Craig. Look, this guy is importing Brazilian beef. We produce enough beef in Ireland, so much so that we export 85 to 90% of it. There's absolutely no need for Larry to go and import any Brazilian beef to add to his products that he sells throughout Europe, presumably so under the logo of Bord Bia.
It is kind of a strange one. If your job is to promote Irish produce, but you choose, even in a country yes. that produces far more beef than it actually consumes, like by a ratio of 8-2 or 8.5-1.5, to then import a controversial product to process that in Ireland. If I were a person in France, I would say, well, your beef can't be that good. You're telling us that it's fantastic, but you're choosing this South American beef yourself. So I suppose the optics of it aren't fantastic.
Yeah, exactly, Greg. I think you've summed it up very well. And as you know, as you probably have known, your listeners are probably have known, you've heard it on the media and in the Farmers' Journal, where AFA and the Farmers' Journal have taken a trip to Brazil, and they have confirmed the use of hormones and goat promoters in the beef farms over there. So there has been traces of these hormones appearing in their exports. So we have absolutely zero confidence in the quality of the beef that's being exported from Brazil into the EU here. So absolutely, Greg, it just doesn't sit, and hence why we're here, and we're here to stay.
That was going to be my final question. Are you literally going to stay there until such time as you get what you want, that you get the chair of Bord Bia either to relinquish his post or to be relieved of it?
Both is very simple answer there, Greg, is yes, we are.
All right, okay. Right, yep. Thanks, Adrian. Look after yourself. Adrian Gallagher, National Chair of the Irish Farmers Association Sheep Committee from Donegal, and is, as we speak and as we spoke, in the offices or in the reception of Bord Bia, and they've made their demands pretty clear there. A texter says it's a bit rich for the Dáil Committee giving out about Elon Musk not sending a representative to answer questions when Pascal Donoghue refused to appear to answer questions about $10 million he handed to the World Bank to secure a big job. Well, people are extrapolating as to that it helped him in getting that job. And I have to say that because we are covered by rules and regs. Oh, yeah, the thing is, I get exactly where you're coming from. And unfortunately, there's always a counter argument. But Elon Musk, you know, was seemingly very keen to holiday with a convicted paedophile, which for me is way out of the stratosphere compared to $10 million going to the World Bank, if you understand where I'm coming from. So whilst I understand there is a similarity in potentially the irony or whatever it might be, Elon Musk's association with a continued association after his conviction for being a paedophile, effectively, is a different kettle of fish for me, to be honest with you. Just to let you know, our next Greg Hughes podcast, the sister podcast, this show is live for you on Friday. There's a bank of them there for you already. Real people, real stories, and some stuff from the archives as well from my time at Northwest Radio and presenting a programme called Be My Guest. There'll be more of that down the line. But don't forget to check out our website here at Highland, or to check out Spotify or iTunes to stay up to date with when those podcasts are released. But I'll give you a tip. It's 11 o'clock on Fridays. Dear Highland Radio, my mummy has helped me to write this and email it to you. I wonder if you could read out this very special message on air for my granny, who will be celebrating her 80th birthday. My granny is called Anne Houston, and she's from Cleandra Dunlow in the beautiful county of Donegal. My granny Anne is simply the best. There is nothing she does not know, from all the players of Celtic Football Club to the Donegal squad, how to beat me at snakes and ladders, to even giving me a good battle at Mario Kart on my Nintendo Switch. My granny is unstoppable. My granny Anne has a class Glaswegian accent, and this makes her jokes, songs and stories about long ago even funnier, especially when she tells me funny stories about my daddy Connell. When you read this special message to my granny Anne today, she will have a big smile, and this will make her day. Tell her I love her forever and hope she has the best day. Love from her boy, Frank Houston, Strabane, aged 7 years. Love you, Granny Cleandra. Aw, isn't that nice? Well done. What a lovely note to get. And a big, big happy birthday to you. On the issue of schools, when I was part of the Voluntary Parents Association and we voluntarily gave this information to parents, when parents realised only a small number paid, the following year we had less than 50 of the 170 kids paying. It was detrimental for the school. I would totally be against this. Yes, publish the spending, but not the amount collected. But the problem with that is, you see, that is, and I'm not saying anyone's being deceptive, but that kind of is a form of deception, because you're relying on all parents believing that the other parent is, the other parents are paying, and then they pay. And, you know, you could have families that are really quite hard pressed, and you don't know what they're sacrificing to pay. So I get exactly where you're coming from. And I know what you're saying is not in any way to try and scam parents, but we have to also think of the impact sort of that level of secrecy might actually have. On the issue of Donegal Airport, hi, yeah, I also saw the Donegal flight petition yesterday, and I shared it and went to sign the petition and was told to go to my email to make sure that my signature would be visible. I did that, and I was asked to pay €5. It said if you pay €5 that this would guarantee another 125 people to sign the petition, so I thought this was a part of what my friend shared on Facebook. So I paid the €5, right? I think it's possible that maybe that petition has been set up on a platform, not necessarily fantastic, but we shall see. Right, we're joined on the programme now by Dr. Ray Bassett. He's a former senior Irish diplomat who held the position of Irish ambassador to Canada, Jamaica and the Bahamas. Good morning to you. Thank you so much for joining us, Ray.
Thank you very much, Greg, and good morning to you.
You spent most of your career working for the Irish government, and a lot to do with the Northern Irish Troubles and conflict resolution, and in fact played a role in those historic negotiations in the late 90s.
Yes, I was probably the longest serving Irish government official working on issues relating to Northern Ireland, and almost 20 years. And a lot of that time was spent actually based in Belfast. And I was part of the Irish government delegation at the Good Friday agreement talks.
Yeah, another person involved at that time was Senator George Mitchell. And recently he's been found to be amongst those named in the Epstein files. And things have moved really quite quickly after this revelation. What has been your reaction to this news?
Well, I think it's very difficult, particularly on this side of the Atlantic, to resist the kind of hue and cry at the moment, because quite clearly some of the material that's coming out from the Epstein files are very, very bad, and it really casts a very poor light on how society is organised. So if you get in the way of it, it's quite a difficult place to be. But there are, I mean, with George Mitchell, there seems to be certainly on the face of it a conflict of evidence between what he was saying and what is coming out of the files. And if you're caught in that situation, even if you're totally innocent, it's a very difficult place to be in. I think people are essentially being cautious because too many people in the past maybe didn't act quickly.
Was there anything about your interactions with George Mitchell that gave you pause for thought or cause for concern?
No, George Mitchell was always a very courteous person. His role in the Good Friday talks is often misunderstood. He was very much a figurehead, and he didn't get into the kind of, you know, negotiations over how many departments would be at Stormont or what the new anti-discrimination legislation is. That George managed to keep on good standing with everybody by essentially acting more as a referee than an actual participant. And it was a huge tribute to him that at the end of the talks, no party on any side had any great difficulty with George. And I think he did that. It was partly because of his experience as a judge and also because he had been in the, you know, chair of companies and that. So he didn't tend to ever develop a partisan view or a very detailed view of any proposal. And by just holding the ring was his job. And I think he did that very, very well. And I think we all owe a great debt of gratitude to George Mitchell.
But unfortunately, if you associate with a convicted paedophile, not unfortunately, but unfortunately for him, these are the consequences of it. And post 2008, you know, anyone who was dealing with Jeffrey Epstein had to be of the knowledge that they were communicating or in contact with a convicted paedophile.
That's true. And the fact that Mitchell said that he didn't have any contact at all, and, you know, there is certainly a big question mark over that. And, of course, there is the most damning thing of all in the case of George Mitchell is Virginia Giuffroy's accusations. And Virginia Giuffroy's accusations, which weren't taken seriously at the start, a lot of them have come true. So it is a very difficult place for George Mitchell. He certainly, the case against him hasn't been proven, but at the same time, he has appeared to consort with people who it would have been an awful lot better for him not to be involved with.
You also would have known Peter Mandelson, and his fall has been really slow and really quick at the same time as these files have been released. He's losing his peerage. He's left the Labour Party and now is the subject of a criminal investigation. Again, another person who stated they had links tenuous enough and have been proven to have not given correct information and are paying the consequences.
Well, you know, while I'd have sympathy for George Mitchell, I'm afraid it doesn't extend to Peter Mandelson. And Peter Mandelson was a very difficult individual that we dealt with during our period of time there. He was very vain, and he was the type of person who sat back looking at his own handiwork and assumed that he was by far and the smartest guy in the room. And we had developed very good relations with the new Blair administration, whether it was Mo Molan, whether it was Murphy, or whether it was John Reid. And Mandelson was a completely different kettle of fish. He was much more like his Tory predecessors and had a kind of a haughty view of it, and didn't really, if he didn't rate somebody, he wouldn't bother engaging in conversation. He had a particular dislike of the loyalists, and the loyalists had a particular dislike of him. He came with the idea that he was going to revive his political career by being a star in Belfast. It wasn't about the actual substance. He was going to be different than the others, and he was going to essentially plough a different path than Mo Molan. And in doing that, he managed to alienate everybody in his attempt to court favour with the Ulster Unionists, who had fallen out of favour with Mo Molan. But by the end of his time in Belfast, even David Trimble had very little time for him. So he managed to alienate everybody across the political spectrum. So
to the point whereby he almost undid the peace process.
He did, because he decided to unpick the Patent Commission. Patent Commission is now a standard document. When I was the ambassador in Canada, people from the Mounties used to come to me regularly who were applying for senior positions in Canada, would apply, ask me for a copy of the Patent Commission report. It's a standard text now in policing. And he decided essentially to unpick it and pick it in a whole series of areas. The whole point of the Patent Commission was to make the new policing arrangements acceptable to all sides of the community. By the efforts he was making it almost impossible for people on the nationalist side, and that included the SDLP as well as Sinn Féin, to accept it, and that would have been a disaster.
In a strange way, and I suppose this is all about perception and spin, he almost looks like a sympathetic character now, yet your experience with him was so much more different. But he obviously knows the right people, because very recently appointed as ambassador to the United States, serious question marks now about the level of vetting of him and resistance from the Labour Party actually to divulge all of that information. You know, it's contagious. This controversy is contagious, and it does make you wonder, how could someone with the information that was out there about him be appointed to such an important role, that critical relationship between the United Kingdom and the United States?
Yeah, he's his own best spin doctor, and I was on lots of meetings with him. I never quite succumbed to the magic, but I think the view was, Greg, that Donald Trump was such an unusual individual that you couldn't, you know, play the game normally. That you had to have somebody, Svengali or some whatever the right term is, who would be very unorthodox. And personally, I was absolutely gobsmacked having sat opposite him, and also, you know, to know his background with the Jeffrey Robinson case, his lobbying on passports and things like that. And I think they just sort of said, we need some magic here in Washington, and to be very unorthodox. And they took a wild guess that this would be the right person, and it was a high risk maneuver, and it backfired spectacularly.
What do you think the political ramifications of this will be for the Labour Party, I suppose, for Keir Starmer? Do you think this will end up going further up the chain?
I think I think Keir Starmer is already damaged, and I think this is a further kick in the teeth for him, if you like. But one other thing that I know, because I worked a lot with Labour Party people, Mandelson was very unpopular. There was almost a fear that this guy has magic arts, so you don't annoy him. But there was no liking for him among his peers in the Labour Party, which again puts question mark as to how he kind of created this aura about himself that he could deliver in areas that others can't. I think it'll be damaging, and I think it again reinforces the wrong belief that all politicians are out on the make. And you know, Mandelson is a very, very unusual character. He is not typical of the Labour Party of Britain or any party in these islands, you know.
Yes, but it is interesting just to hear you describe him. His character traits are seemingly quite similar to a lot of the people that we found to be associated with Jeffrey Epstein and Epstein himself. It's just interesting.
There is an adoration of the of glamour and of wealth, which, you know, it seems to attract people, politicians include some politicians on it, but it's a very, very unhealthy development in a society. And I mean, anyone who's working inside government, you do see, okay, appointments which you scratch your head at, and you know this is done because of links between individuals, and is not on merit by any manner of means.
Okay, listen, thank you very much indeed for your insight and your expertise. Look after yourself. That is Dr. Ray Bassett. He's a former senior Irish diplomat who held the position of Irish ambassador to Canada, Jamaica and the Bahamas. He also worked with and knew, certainly was working on the same project as Senator George Mitchell and the now disgraced Peter Mandelson and George Mitchell, I suppose, too, is disgraced because a leading university in Northern Ireland is cutting ties with the former US senator over his links to Jeffrey Epstein. What are they doing? They are they've removed a bust of him and have also denamed a peace centre that was named after him. So a lot of stuff is coming out in the wash. On the issue of farming, Board Beer has markets and provides a quality assurance for beef that is processed in Ireland, not beef from cattle produced in Ireland. A distinction as a farmer's son, I was not aware of it until last week. Indeed, but that's not a distinction that everyone is aware of, and those dual roles can be quite confusing. Another, processing foreign beef and putting an Irish Board Beer sticker on it makes a mockery of the Board Beer guarantee. The pressure has to be maintained until the government takes responsibility, or else tell us why Larry Moran had more control than the Department of Agriculture. We're joined on the programme now by Suzanne Scott, barrister and the head of research at the Centre of Justice and Law Reform. Suzanne, thank you so much for your time today.
Good morning, Greg. Thanks for having me.
I suppose different outlets have taken different headlines from this report. So maybe I might ask you, what do you feel is the most notable thing to come from this report? Is it how slow the wheels of justice turn? Is it how we see more crime in this jurisdiction than others?
Yes, thanks, Greg. The first thing to say, I suppose, about the paper is that this is the first publication by the Centre for Justice and Law Reform, which is a research centre newly established by the Law Society of Ireland. And its purpose is to conduct research and make recommendations to improve the justice system and shape law reform to better serve the public interest. So this is the Justice Indicators paper is our first publication, and the purpose is to provide evidence for evidence-based policymaking in the justice system. So what I would see in that regard as the biggest finding is the lack of data that we actually have. And that might sound strange because we've pulled together data from 101 sources, I think it was, nationally and internationally, and brought them together across the four pillars of the justice system, that being trust, policing, the courts and prisons. But actually, one of our key findings is that we need more data.
Where are the gaps in the Irish data compared to our counterparts?
Well, for example, in relation to how long it takes for the courts to process a case, our findings show that on average, we're three times longer than our EU counterparts. But actually, and we've made it very clear in the research, that there's major data gaps in Ireland in relation to the length of proceedings. So, for example, we don't have any data on how long civil matters take in the district or circuit courts since 2020. So that's a basic data gap that we just don't know. And we've made that very clear in the research, that our best calculation is that the proceedings take three times as long. But we're calling on the court service to publish data, key data that are missing. Another big data gap in relation to the courts is the extent of the case backlog. So that's cases that have been in the system for a year or longer. And we just don't know how many cases that is or how long those cases have been in the system. And that's another big data gap as well. Mm. In relation to the sexual offences detection rate, again, our data show that our detection rate is quite low. However, and one of the key recommendations we've made is that in the context of the reporting of historical crimes, there's evidential difficulties to overcome when incidents are reported later. Mm. And therefore, we've asked for the detection rates to be disaggregated or separated so that we can see, as there has been a lot of resources put into the courts in relation to the investigation of sexual offences, have improvements actually been made, or are the low detection rates reflective of the high proportion of historical incidents reported?
Yeah, just the headline on the coverage of all of this from RTE is a new report comparing Ireland's justice system to other countries has shown the average number of sexual offences committed here between 2019 and 2023 was 43% higher than the EU average. So in that data, how do we know that this is a greater number of crimes committed versus a greater detection of crimes, Right, so we could be comparing a police force in the Republic that's very active and very good at securing, you know, convictions or investigating sexual offences. And we could have a country like Spain that might have quite a relaxed attitude to it in terms of resources. I'm not saying that's the case. I'm just pulling an example. So from this data that you've pulled, how can we conclude that we have a higher number of sexual offences committed compared to other nations?
So those data are actually, it's separate from detection. So those are the number of incidents that are reported to An Garda Síochána, and then they are published by the Centre.
Yeah, but how do we know that we, because of all the awareness, because of all of the campaigning and the great work from advocacy groups, rape crisis networks, how do we know that we don't have better reporting?
Yeah,
as opposed to a greater incident? Because this is the way this is framed, okay? The way this is framed, and we're not saying it's the case, and by the way, I'm certainly not being defensive, but the way this is framed, it doesn't actually, we don't actually have the data to prove that we have. So that's a misleading headline.
Well, what we're saying is we're not trying to criticise or draw any conclusions from the data. We're simply saying the data show that compared to our EU counterparts, we have a higher number of incidents. But we make it very clear in our.
But it says here
analysis.
Committed. It says here committed, not reported.
Well, if they're reported, then they're committed. I mean, I think that goes hand in hand. But we've made it very clear in the analysis that we don't know whether the offences that are reported. So they're reported and collected for the reported the year that they're reported. So there's no differentiation made between when the offences were committed. And there's been a lot of work done, as you rightly point out, to alleviate some of the stigma around reporting sexual offences. And that's to be commended. And we haven't made any criticism of that. We're simply saying that reporting is up. And and as a result, of course, this will be across the board in the EU as well.
And we're not drawing any
conclusions. We're simply saying
this is the data
that are available publicly from reputable sources show that comparatively we have a higher number of incidents in Ireland as compared to our EU counterparts.
And this is just to clear up my ignorance, Suzanne. It's not so from a legal perspective, as a barrister, there is no connotations with the word committed. As you've stated, reporting and committed are one and in the same, yep?
Well, I'm not sure which headline you're referring to. All I can say is the data that we've looked at is offences that are reported. So we've looked at the recorded crime incidents, so that's reported. We haven't looked beyond conviction or further down the line. That's potentially something we could look at in further iterations of that project. What we've looked at are the crime statistics that are published by An Garda Síochána and then made available to the public via the Central Statistics Office.
This is very useful, isn't it, in that how can you police or target resources or really address what might be going on if you've got the big gaps in the data that you talk of? So from a government perspective, I think, or an An Garda Síochána perspective, that's a really interesting space that they need to look into. Suzanne, would you agree?
Absolutely, yes. And we have some interesting data. So we looked at spending across the three pillars of the justice system. So An Garda Síochána, the courts and prisons, and then expressed those as a percentage of the entire justice budget. And it's very interesting to see that actually An Garda Síochána gets quite a high percentage of the justice budget, whereas the courts it appears to be underfunded, at least compared to our EU counterparts. So the data that we have indicates that Ireland spend on average €38 per capita on the courts, whereas the EU average is €52. So that's we're below our counterparts in that regard.
And just in terms of sentiment, confidence in the judiciary, the Gardaí, higher in Ireland?
Yes, exactly. So trust in the Gardaí, comparatively high across the board. That's from data from the OECD. So in 2023, trust in the Gardaí was 70% and the OECD average was 63%. And then for the Irish courts, 69% of the Irish population trusted the courts compared to 54% across the OECD.
Yeah, and again, just to reiterate, because I think this is a pivotal thing, if we're ever talking about reform of whatever in terms of justice, the justice system, that has to be based on good data. That's common sense,
exactly.
And I think we all could agree on that, certainly, couldn't
yeah,
we,
exactly.
Suzanne?
Yeah, and that's ultimately what the purpose of this project is. It's not to point the finger or criticise any one particular institution. It's simply to lay out the status quo now, set out the data that we do have, call for more data, and emphasise the need for data to underpin justice policymaking.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Suzanne. I really appreciate your time. Suzanne Scott, barrister and head of research at the Centre for Justice and Law Reform. I just think it's very important when you have a public service broadcaster that's funded to the tune of €750 million that they get what a report is about. And that's what I was teasing out with Suzanne, and I hope she doesn't feel I was questioning her, but the reporting in that the headline, because this is going to be spread all over the world, the headline is Ireland's sexual offences rate 43% higher than the EU average. But that doesn't necessarily hold true, because the data isn't there to actually support it, because we don't know where these reports have we got a higher reporting incident rate? Are the Gardaí better at encouraging people to report? Do we do better in terms of giving people the confidence to report? So in other words, there could be the equal rate in another country, just it's better reporting here. I hope your Wednesday is going well for you. Myself and Caroline were just waffling, I suppose, or chatting about how the speed with which the days seem to be going. I don't know about you, if that's how you feel, but it certainly feels like the weeks are flying in, notwithstanding, of course, that many of us did have Monday off. But I was pointing out recently, February, it is a great month, you know, because we get an awful lot of extra daylight over the course of February, just because of the Earth turning on its axis and going around the sun and all that kind of malarkey. Well, the day gets longer by 2 hours and 8 minutes. So stand firm. We've got January out of the way, and by the end of February, we'll have an extra 2 hours and 8 minutes of glorious daylight, which is good. Greg, am I mistaken? It was Peter Mandelson once interviewed on Highland Radio at the time of the peace process. Not but I, yes, but he was. He was staying in Remelton at the time and was on a former incarnation of this programme, if I'm not mistaken. I didn't hear it. I don't know what he was like. Michael English. There's a lot of guys on the circuit. Michael English is one of the best, I think. He always puts on a good show. There is a Burt charity concert with Michael English in concert. It's in St. Angus Church in Burt. And he's quite a spiritual guy too, I'd imagine, judging by his style. It's on Sunday, the 22nd of February. Doors open at 7. The show starts at 8. Tickets are €30. It's a Burt charity concert. We have some contact numbers here. There's no point me reading them out because you're not sitting there ready with a pen. But anyway, if you want to get along, see Michael English in concert in St. Angus Church, Burt. Tickets are €30, and it's the Burt charity concert, so it's for a good cause. We got notification from the Northwest Breast Cancer Ball 2025 organisers. It raised €20,360. So if you went along to that, I hope you had a fantastic time and you contributed significantly to the efforts in terms of research and supports, etc. So reading on here, the Northwest Breast Cancer Ball 2025 has been hailed as an outstanding success, raising an incredible €20,360 in support of breast cancer services and research across the Northwest. Breast cancer continues to touch the lives of families throughout Donegal, and the ball serves not only as a vital fundraising initiative, but also as a powerful reminder of solidarity, hope and community support for those navigating diagnoses, treatment and recovery. So that's remarkable. And we are leaders in research here in the Northwest under the guidance of Mr. Michael Sugru. That barrister says if it's been reported, it's committed. If a person reports a crime, it definitely doesn't mean it happened. How many times have people accused of a crime and been found innocent, or the accuser drops the case? I was just a little bit curious, perhaps I shouldn't have queried it on air as I did. I didn't mean to over inquire. It's just I would have thought reporting and committing are two different things, and you know, maybe that's RTE's headline
and not really the basis of the report. And maybe RTE need to look at how they've reported that information just to make sure it's actually fully reflective of the facts, because it's 750 million euro to get the truth out, right? Okay, I have to take a very short break. I'm going to be back with Deputy Pat the Cope Gallagher. We're going to be talking about the proposed changes to the schedule at Donegal Airport. By all accounts, we've spoken to those who know the crack. Of course, it's vital in terms of getting tourism into the area. There are concerns that the new schedule will not really facilitate that. There's concerns there'll be an empty flight coming up from Dublin in the morning. There is concerns that this vital service for people across the region, by the way, not just the Dunloe area, to access cancer care. Fantastic relationships have been built up with hospitals down there to try and get morning appointments. 98% of the time that morning flight will get you there. If it's departing from Dublin, we're waiting on it to land. Will it be delayed? Will it land? This has massive implications. It's not just an inconvenience. This is potentially survival, life and death. We'll be back talking about that again after these. As I mentioned, I'm joined on the programme now by Fianna Fáil Deputy Pat the Cope Gallagher. Good morning to you, Pat. Do you share the concerns of various groups and individuals that these proposed changes will have a very negative impact on us here in the Northwest?
Of course, Greg, needless to say, I share that, and I've been working on that for the last 3 weeks. I was delighted to learn that the contract would be signed some weeks ago for the new PSO commencing in January 2026. And I was told that there would be an 8 o'clock flight in the morning, but that's all I was told. So I delved behind the scenes to find that the whole schedule has changed. And as you mentioned before the break, that the first flight would be going out of Dublin at 6:30 in the morning, going to Donegal back at 8, going back in the evening at 7 o'clock and coming back at 8:30. Well, I described those two flights, the morning flight, early morning flight, the late evening flight, as phantom flights. There will be nobody travelling on those flights. It makes no sense whatsoever. And I know yesterday that you debated the issue about the midday flights, which are so important to many people, including those who are going to Dublin for medical appointments, up in the morning, back in the afternoon. So this makes no sense. In actual fact, it's costing the government more to provide these services now. And while I believe it's only two services that will be used as against four the last time. So it's going to cost money. It makes no sense whatsoever. And immediately I became aware of this. Unfortunately, I became aware. I met straight to the minister. He is working with his officials on that since then. On the following day after I heard it, I travelled to Donegal. By coincidence with Minister Jack Chambers, who had responsibility for transport at one stage and was very familiar and very supportive of retaining the schedule is there at the moment, as is the Minister, I must say, and the Taoiseach. So talks are ongoing. I came in here 45 years ago, and this is the most serious problem, like many others, that I've encountered because of the importance of the daily flights to Dublin. And I'm not giving up easily. I'm back in Dublin today, and I'll be having further meetings with those on high to try and convince them that what has been done is wrong. There was a tender which issued last year, and it just said one on weekdays flights to Dublin, one in the morning and one in the evening, but it wasn't spelt out about the middle of the day because it was taken for granted that this would happen. And the advantage of having the early morning flight out of Donegal, and I must thank the late Mary O'Rourke, who was Minister for Transport, she insisted on that. Because we know the night before, as I did last night, called, found out the plane is going there, sort of be going up in the morning. What will happen in weeks to come if this schedule is introduced, we won't know until 7:30 in the morning if they're coming or not. And if they're not coming, then we have to find another way. It makes no sense whatsoever.
Just to be clear, to try and timeline this, then the tender that was offered was a redrafted tender compared to the tender that was put out before? Is it that there was a morning flight and just an evening flight? So that's what airlines were tendering on?
No, what it said on this, Greg, is that the schedules must include an early morning flight from Donegal Airport departing not later than 8 to Dublin, and a late evening flight from Dublin to Donegal not earlier than 6:30. That was fine, but it followed then that the only other flight would be in the middle of the day, as it is in the moment, leaving Dublin at 12:55 and returning at 2:30. And there was no consultation with the airport or the airport authorities in relation to this. So we and the state will be paying the successful tenderer, if they are to proceed with this schedule, to go up empty. I doubt if anybody will be travelling. It was said to me that it will catch flights coming in from the United States at 6:30 in the morning. That means they have to be in by 4 or 4:30. And anyone who wants to travel to Donegal in the morning have to be at the airport at 5 o'clock. No public transport. It doesn't make sense at all. And it's just a licence to print money.
Yeah, but again, I understand that you say that things were a given, Pat. But if that what was what put out is that if that's what was put out for tender, and someone was successful in it, what they have proposed, this new schedule, does actually match that tender. So the fault here goes back to whomever. We can't work on presumptions, can we? It's at the tendering process that the ball was dropped here, then.
But it's worked well since 1994, and there was no necessity to change it. And a PSO, as you'll understand, is a public service obligation. It's to provide a service to those in the regional and peripheral areas that are more than 4 hours from Dublin. And in fact, I was the one in the European Parliament in the 90s that ensured that there was an amendment note included that airports where it took more than 4 hours to travel by road would be included. That's why we have a public service obligation. So we're here to serve the people. We're not here to serve private company.
So how do we progress this then? So, I mean, I presume parking an aeroplane in Dublin overnight and then and all the taxiing and all that in the morning is more expensive than it's sitting in Donegal Airport. I could be wrong in relation to that. But it's going to require negotiations with the airline to say, look at, you know, you might have tendered for this, but we want that.
Well, if it costs money to do that, I'm quite confident that that can be provided. But their airline who are there at the moment are doing extremely well. I met people at the airport this morning, and one person travelled down to the Dublin-Donegal match on last Saturday week. They paid 150 one way. I met somebody this morning that was going to Dublin and back this evening, 150 return. And that is on top of the subsidy that they're getting. The Department of Transport should have another look at this, and I believe I'm hoping they'll have, because my contacts are not with the officials. My contacts are with the minister, his advisors, the Taoiseach, his advisor, and I would hope that I will be meeting them again today to try and prevail upon them the importance of continuing and not fixing it when it's not broken. And let me say, and I know you have debated this yesterday, but take, for instance, someone who's leaving this morning and they want to fly on to Europe or wherever. They know from the night before, and that's the advantage of knowing the night before. They're safe, whereas they would have to wait until 7:30 in the morning. Is it in the air? Will it land? Doesn't land, then they've missed all their connecting flights. It doesn't make any sense at all, and it's wrong.
Unfortunately, it does potentially begin the journey of it being gone altogether, because then if this schedule is actually enforced, the numbers won't justify the PSO. That's what we'll hear in a year or two or three or four or whenever it's coming up for review. But that would have been because it's completely impractical. So you have contacts with the people at the very top, right? When are we going to get a positive decision in relation to this? And what will you do if you don't get a resolution to this?
Well, I'm always an optimist, and I will be doing my utmost to ensure that it continues providing the schedule that it has. And I have grown up politically with Donegal Airport, and I remember the grass airstrip when Anthony Gillespie, Cathal McSivney and the Forker brothers got involved and provided the service with Malin Air. So I have many a time I travelled to Glasgow, even Donegal at 3 in the morning, to go to talk to Logan Air to try and convince them to come from here. So it's very much and very close to me, and I'll just wait and see what develops. But I'm adamant that approval must be given. And if we look at this on a financial basis, by whatever criteria you take into consideration, it makes no economic sense. Mm. If one is to do a study of this and the cost, and remember, the flights are very expensive. It costs now as much to go from Donegal to Dublin while you're booking a last-minute flight as it would go for a weekend in Paris or in other parts.
Do you not think it's important we find out who drafted this tender, though, Pat? Is that not important? Did the airline have any influence over it, for an example?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I can't answer that. I can't. But let me tell you, when I came in to the Dáil in the 1987 election, we were going into government, and I heard that the Department of Transport were saying in that time that it's not wise to continue investing money in Donegal Airport, which is very much in its infancy at that time. I proceeded immediately to the Minister for Finance, Ray McSharry, very familiar with West Donegal, with John Wilson, the Minister for Transport, Tottenham Letterkenny for years, and they said to me very clearly, don't fear, we will ensure that the development of Donegal Airport will continue.
Okay.
And then in 1994, commenced the PSOs, and it's been going extremely well since then.
And
it's important to remember,
it's important
to remember that there are 190 direct and indirect jobs. It contributes 86 million in economic output. Last year, there were 55,000 passengers recorded in 2025, an increase of 9%. And of course, that deals with the health. And when I see the patients who are going down for appointments in St. Luke's and other hospitals in Dublin, they're picked up, they're taken to the hospital, straight back again. How can those people go down for an early morning appointment if they have to be away at 6:30 in the morning?
Okay, understood, but I must go because unfortunately my schedule's been adjusted as well, so I'm out of time. Thank you very much for that. That's Deputy Pat the Cope Gallagher. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.